I'm here today as a recipient of the David T. McLaughlin Leadership Fund Scholarship for the 2017 Aspen Security Forum. I'm honored to introduce our next session, One State, Two State, where we will examine the prospects for peace between Israelis and the Palestinians under the Trump administration. We, of course, are reminded this week of the urgency of peace, as violent clashes in Jerusalem this week have resulted in the deaths of 3 Israelis and 6 Palestinians. Diplomatic tensions are also high following Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas's decision to freeze all contacts with the Israeli government until it halts new security measures imposed around Al-Aqsa Mosque. Moderating our session this afternoon is Ken Delanian. Ken covers national security in Washington for NBC News Investigative Unit, writing for the web, reporting for the nightly news, and regularly appearing on MSNBC. He previously wrote about intelligence and security for the Associated Press, the Los Angeles Times, USA Today, and the Philadelphia Inquirer, where he was a foreign correspondent covering the Iraq War. Ken graduated from Williams College in 1991 with a degree in political science and in history. Please join me in welcoming Ken and our distinguished panelists today.
Thank you so much, and thanks to Clark and to Walter and to the Aspen Institute for having us today, and thanks to the diehards who are still here on Saturday afternoon. This is a sadly timely panel. As we gather here today, crisis is unfolding over the Al-Aqsa Mosque, one of Islam's holiest sites in Jerusalem. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas announced he was freezing relations with Israel yesterday. As we just heard, a number of people have been killed. At issue is a shooting rampage and a response by the Israelis to install metal detectors at the holy site. And I'm going to let our panel fill us in on the details and to talk about the implications, and also to get on to the main topic of our panel, which is the two-state solution dead? To break down this extraordinarily complex issue, I'm pleased to introduce my distinguished panel. To my right is Ned Walker, former ambassador to Israel and many other places. Natan Sachs, director of the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. Aaron David Miller, vice president for new initiatives and distinguished scholar at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. And Hussam Zamlat, strategic affairs advisor to the president of the state of Palestine. Hussam, can we begin with you, and can you try to explain to us what is happening right now with the mosque? Why are we seeing this violence? And then we'll throw it to the rest of the panel to talk about the implications.
Can you allow me, Ken, before we go into that tragedy and sadness, to thank Clark and the Aspen Institute for this great opportunity of having being part of this discussion and meeting almost everybody I needed to meet for 2 years, but only in two days. Thank you, Clark. And everybody, I have been newly appointed as the head of the PLO delegation to the U.S., so I needed all that time to meet all of you. So now you are all in one room. And thank you also for bringing me to this beautiful city of Aspen. You know, as I was flying from Denver to Aspen, I sat next to a nice old lady in her 90s. I saw her drinking a huge, bottle of something looked like a beer. Huge one. I looked at her and I said, "You're having a good time." She looked at me and said, "You young man, no, I'm just having liquid. Prepare yourself for the altitude." I looked at her and I said, "What altitude? I live in Ramallah. It's like 800 meters high." She said, "Wait until you get there." I have to say, I remember her yesterday and today. But nonetheless, going back to your question, it is, I was reading an Israeli op-ed writer, Shemi Shalev, this morning, and actually his article captured my feeling, my personal feeling. He was talking about sleep paralysis, which is when you are sleeping and you are about to witness a nightmare. You think you're awake, full awake, and you start shouting as you are dreaming, and you wanted this to stop, you know where you're going. And this is exactly the feeling we're having at this point in time. You know, tempering with the Al-Aqsa Mosque, with that situation, is exactly the nightmare we should have avoided. Nonetheless, you know what happened. Only last week, there was a very unfortunate, condemned killing, 3 Israeli Arab citizens, killed 2 Israeli Arab citizens in Jerusalem outside the mosque President Abbas immediately condemned, called Netanyahu, and there was an agreement that the status quo will be maintained. The mosque was closed for the first time since 1967 for 48 hours, sorry. And then electronic gates were installed on the gates of the mosque. Now, the gates were installed against the advice of the Israeli security forces, against the advice of Jordan, and Jordan was engaging the Israelis, telling them, you must respect and restore the status quo, and Jordan is the custodian of the holy sites in Jerusalem, against the advice of the U.S., and you have heard the U.S. State Department stating, and the White House clearly, that the status quo must be maintained. Unfortunately, Netanyahu insisted on the decision, and then, boom, what we have now is confrontations, because they have touched upon the very unnerved tooth of the Palestinian people, which is their, you know, their identity and their heritage and their connection to the holy sites and to Jerusalem. Yesterday it was very unfortunate and sad, as was just said. Three Israelis lost their lives and seven Palestinians lost their lives, regrettably. And the situation is escalating. The Palestinian leadership met last night. President Abbas announced the suspension of all ties. This is with Israel. This is the first time since 2005. That such suspension happens because of the gravity of the situation. And I think the main message by President Abbas and the leadership is that coordination between us and Israel is always done in good faith for a political horizon, not in bad faith to timber with the status quo. And we should not take this for granted, and we should always coordinate and cooperate and keep contact under a political horizon and the political context.
Can I just drill down on one thing, though? Because, you know, sometimes we get numb to the violence and to these stories, and we don't fully understand them. This is a very serious situation, as you guys all explained to me. Ned, can you talk about why the status quo is so important and why this seemingly benign step of installing metal detectors has caused such a problem?
Well, we've had the status quo for quite some time, and there have been only a couple of occasions when it's broken down, usually by the act of an individual, whether he was subsequently determined to be insane with the Al-Aqsa fire, or the case where a person opened fire with automatic weapons. In each case, obviously the reaction was very severe, but it was tamped down by virtue of the responsibility of the governments and so on and far involved. Now, there has always been this basic problem of status quo. The basic status quo was an agreement reached years ago in which Israeli or the Waqf, the Islamic Waqf, would be the administrator of the site and the Israelis would have security control.
Just to be clear, this is one of the holiest sites of Islam, right?
And that is correct.
That's why the status quo, that phrase, what does that mean?
Well, the status quo means that you will keep the fact that the Islamic Waqf will manage the holy sites for the benefit of everybody. It'll be open. The agreement with Diane was that Jews would be allowed to pray in the holy sites, but not, they're allowed to visit as tourists, but not to pray. And this agreement had no clear element of security, except the Israelis are there, and they are the ones that have the security capability, and that's been understood. The problem that we're reaching out right now is the fear that that status quo will be changed. And the idea is that, as much as it seems silly to a lot of us to put, you know, since we go through them all the time, these magnetometers on the entrance to it, some of the Palestinians are inclined to believe the worst intentions, and that indeed this is just the first step. And the next thing you know, there's going to be a check on individuals coming in, who's here and who's not. And so we have always been able to manage this with our own help and with others' help by sticking strictly with the status quo. This changed the status quo.
And Natan and then Aaron, why did Netanyahu do what he did, and what are the implications?
Well, I'm a Jerusalemite myself, and I have to say it's there's sort of two points I take away from it. The first is that reason and rationality seem to always stop at the entrance to my hometown. If it sounds absurd to you that security measures like metal detectors in the entrance to a very volatile site right after a deadly attack, that would spark opposition, if that sounds absurd to you, it's because it's absurd. The problem is that it's we've seen this in Jerusalem time again. So, for example, status quo in Jerusalem, it's not just Jews and Muslims, by the way. If you look at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, if you go in, look up to the right, there's a ladder there that's been there since the 18th century. It cannot be moved because of a status quo between the different churches of Christianity and who exactly has the right to control that little ledge on which that ladder sits. This is Jerusalem. It's the mm-hmm. beauty, but it's also the terror of it. But it's not just irrationality. It's also responsibility, the political responsibility that comes from that. And so when, for example, tempers flare over these things, is the question is, what do political leaders do over this? For years, people have been motivated around Haram al-Sharif, the area in which Al-Aqsa Mosque sits, known in Hebrew as Temple Mount or Har HaBayit. And for both sides, this is extremely emotive, touching on religious core beliefs. Seems to, it mixes the national conflict with the religious aspect to it, which I think is the most dangerous aspect of this whole thing. And there's also a lot of people who make enormous political mileage off of it. The second intifada, the bloodiest time of the last few decades, was called the Al-Aqsa Intifada by the Palestinian leadership, in part using this. This decision by Netanyahu also has a lot to do with domestic Israeli politics. As Hossam said, it was against the advice of at least several of the Israeli security forces, not the police. And they decided to go with it anyway, in part because appearing to be weak and not going for metal detectors, when security is the Israeli responsibility, that would seem absurd. And so we have this very dangerous powder keg. It's sort of the powder keg of all powder kegs, usually the example that's given in international relations. But the response to that, to my mind, is not to throw one's hands up, but to take serious political responsibility. That means not using it for political purposes, and that's true not just of Israelis and Palestinians, but of many in the region who have used this opportunity. Mahmoud Abbas is not one of them, actually. He was the one who immediately condemned this attack. Very few others in the region did. And there was actually an attack. That is how this whole thing started, it's worth remembering. And to calm the situation down. I think, I suspect, I hope that the decision on the metal detectors will be reversed. But it's worth remembering, even if it's reversed and something else is done, in any constellation, in any point of view, even if Israel is an occupier in this territory, security is its responsibility. It is the responsibility of an occupying force. Of course, Israel does not consider itself an occupier.
I got to let Aaron jump in here and tell me about what are the implications. Where is this going? And how is this a microcosm for the entire subject of our
program? Right. First, let me say it's an honor to be at Aspen and to be sitting here with Natan, with Ned, Ken with you, and Hossam with you too. Sitting between Israelis and Palestinians, which I haven't done in quite some time, at least in a practical sense, reminds me of the old days. And it's a transition, basically, to the nature of the problem. This won't be the first time that proximity, passion, and politics, which are the three Ps, the three key ingredients which create combustion, in one of the most fraught and sensitive components of the Israeli-Palestinian problem. We saw this in 1990. We saw it again, sadly, at the end of September, a month or so after Camp David, with Ariel Sharon's visit to Haram al-Sharif, Temple Mount. And we're going to see it again. And the real question, it seems to me, is how do, when you talk about status quo, you're not talking about status quo just on the mount. I mean, mags on the mount do constitute, and the response is would seem rational and logical. Why not put mags at the two main entrances to...
You're listening to a live broadcast from the Aspen Security Forum during our summer membership drive. We bring you these live broadcasts with your financial support. Please call 920-9000 or pledge online at aspenpublicradio.org.
Well, mags become a symbol of control. Mags become a symbol of constriction of Palestinian rights. And I think in a world where... I said this to somebody the other day. If you're looking for logic and rationale, Switzerland would be a better model and a place to be. I remember, my final point, maybe a transition to negotiations. I remember at the Camp David summit in July of 2000, by the way, I'll remind myself and everybody else here, that 17 years ago, this week, Ehud Barak, Yasser Arafat, and William Jefferson Clinton met at what I would argue was the only, well, a unique effort to go for the quote-unquote ultimate deal. Three empowered leaders, Bill Clinton, who cared more about this issue than probably any of his predecessors, Yasser Arafat, a man, complicated man, but with great authority and legitimacy to make compromises if he wanted to. and an Israeli prime minister who was clearly risk-ready and interested in an ultimate deal, although unwilling to close it, it would seem to me. The eighth day of that summit, discussion turned to Jerusalem. I raise this only because to demonstrate the whole issue of rationality and logic when it comes to competing Israeli and Palestinian and Muslim and Jewish claims to Haram al-Sharif Temple Mount, Har HaBayit, Haram al-Sharif. It is overlapping sacred space. Overlapping sacred space in a tiny area. Below lies the remains of both of the Jewish temples. Above lies not two mosques, the Dome of the Rock and Al-Aqsa, sacred, with tremendous resonance to Muslims. Billions of individuals, including Jews and in other parts of the city, Christians, will never set foot in Jerusalem. And yet it's an evocative symbol. We tried on that eighth day to offer any number of fixes to Mr. Barak and Mr. Arafat. We tried sovereignty above ground. Let the Palestinians control the mosques. Sovereignty below ground to the Israelis. No excavation, no digging. Jews are forbidden to set foot on the Temple Mount lest they tread on the Holy of Holies. And since no one knows precisely where that is, you build a wall around the law to ensure that nobody violates it.
Okay, Aaron, let's...
And as a consequence, my only point is Jerusalem represents why the status quo is so fraught, and it also represents why it's so fundamentally difficult to try and change.
And now that we've established that, let's talk about a hopeful sign. Last week, Israel and the Palestinian Authority announced an agreement that will provide millions of cubic meters of drinking water to the Palestinians from a desalinization process. I guess you guys tell me this deal has been in the works for some time, but it was finalized by Donald Trump's envoy, Jason Greenblatt, who hailed it as a harbinger of things to come. So, Hassan, who is Jason Greenblatt, and what is the Trump administration doing right now to try to make peace?
And be very careful.
And be what?
Very careful with what you say.
Before I answer your question, because it's crucial that we do not depict the situation purely from the security prism. This is not just the story of some electronic gates after a security incident. This has historic background. And, Israel is not an innocent player in this whole situation. Netanyahu isn't. And let me start by saying that Netanyahu has already decided to ally himself with two groups in Israel. The first are the non-solutionists, the settler movement, who don't want any solution. And I can quote you many of them in his cabinet, non-solutionists. The second are the Armageddonists, those who believe in the Armageddon and the religious, and Nathan can quote you so many of them. And much of his actions are because of his alliance with these two groups. For the last 10 years, there have been serious threats of by the Palestinian public. They are seeing the change of the status quo, starting by the Israeli police getting inside the mosque and preventing hundreds of thousands of Palestinians from the right of worship. Many, many days of the week, they would come up with less than 45 years old are out, more than 45 years old, and you know that. And then in this 10 years, exsification happened, the digging underneath, which really worries the Palestinian public. Thirdly, it's the issue of all these extreme groups coming in, not for visit, as the agreement, historic. By the way, this status quo was established during the Ottoman Empire, 1851. The ladder Nathan referred to, it's very sacred to people's heart. And we are talking about a mosque. Ken, we are talking about a mosque. And the mosque is a place for worship for Muslims. There are quarters for the Christians. There is the Jewish quarter, okay? There is the Walling Wall, the Western Wall. Things have been arranged, and short of reaching a political settlement, the best is to keep it so you don't tamper with people's emotions. But Netanyahu is doing this, not innocently. He wants to provoke because of your question, because he does not want to heed the Trump call. He feels that there is a political wave coming his way. And the best tactic, this is something we have lived for 17 years. First, distractions. So all what we hear from Netanyahu is incitement, that the Palestinian leader incite our payments to prisoners. Second is the issue of, exporting the whole thing outside. So it's Iran, the risk and the threat, not the Palestinians. And thirdly, and the most common used, provocation. So they provoke the Palestinians via these metal detectors to go into confrontations to avert the Jason Greenblatt event. Coming to Jason.
About Jason Greenblatt.
Coming Thank to you. Jason. You know, it's crucial that I explain this situation, because it's unfair that we Palestinians have put our skin in this for 25 years, and Aaron knows this, trying to build the infrastructure for a final agreement. Anyway, President Trump calls my president in March this year. I was standing next by the president. At that time, I was his advisor before I was sent to the U.S. President Trump asked my president, he said, are you in for a deal? And my president immediately responded, I am, and I have everything ready for a deal. I have a vision. The vision is fully supported by the Arab region, the Arab Peace Initiative. Israeli flag will fly in 57 countries should this vision be implemented. I have international consensus. We just had a UN Security Council resolution. And I have the Palestinian Authority and the infrastructure and the cooperation and coordination with the Israeli Authority that have been very fruitful in the security, economic. I am ready for a deal, Mr. President. And then to which Mr. Trump said, I invite you to the White House. And he informed us that he has appointed three for this task. That is President Trump. Jared Kushner, Jason Greenblatt, and David Friedman. That's the decision of the president. We did visit the White House, and what we heard was absolutely thrilling, exciting, renewing, because the U.S. president has told us what we always wanted to hear and what we always believed to be the real way forward. First, that he is personally interested in this. He believes he can do it. He thinks it's possible, because he's always after the impossible deals, and he thinks he can do the ultimate deal. And you know what? It's good to have a president early on interested in resolving. We should celebrate. We should be happy. Second, he told us in the meeting in the White House that he is not after meal peace deals. He's after final package. Exactly what should happen. This is exactly where we should be thinking. A final package, discussing the final issues, as opposed to being lost in the details. Thirdly, he told us that he is not interested in a process. He wants a short period. And you know what? I'm not going to talk about how harmful that process that has become lasting process as opposed to lasting peace. All the peace industry that has lived with us for 25 years. I know I'm short of time, but
there's a but coming, and I think I can help you with it.
You know what? We're happy to...
The but is that in February he made that statement where he seemed to abandon decades of U.S. support for the two-state solution.
I'm coming to that.
Okay.
I'm coming to that. But it's crucial for us that we disrupt this peace process. That started with a discussion that I just had with Aaron about, you know, no secret to Israel, or what was the policy.
No surprise
during the negotiations. So this means that the U.S. never played the role of the fair mediator, because you have to show whatever proposal the U.S. come with to the Israeli side, and then they have to revise it, and it becomes an Israeli proposition. And the peace industry goes on and on about security first, outside in, whatever that means, outside in, as if peace can be done between Israel and the Arab world without really resolving the Palestinian issue. It's a fantasy. It's a fallacy. And so forth. It's good that President Trump does not want a process, wants to go head on. Fourthly, he said, I want to be the arbitrator. And here you go. We want him to be the arbitrator. We want the U.S. to be the arbitrator. We want the U.S. to play the role of the fair mediator in this, as opposed to presenting the Israeli proposals all the time. Then he dispatches his team. We have been engaging his team. His team has managed to travel to the region several times. I have met his team several times in the White House. We have been engaging. I cannot tell you what his team tells us. It's too early. They have to come up with their own vision. They will, hopefully, inshallah. But I can tell you what we told the team. What we told them is it's crucial that the starting point is that we all recognize the final destination. We cannot start a journey without knowing where we're going. Even though the Brits say, I'm on my way, you know, I don't know where I'm going, but I'm on my way. But in this regard, the two-state solution is our destination. We told the team we want to be sure that we are talking about the two-state solution, because we have tried, you know, all the other forms, and it took us 70 years. Let's not start from point zero. I can tell you that until now, we have not heard from the U.S. team a confirmation that where we're going is actually the two-state solution.
Well, and that's
solution.
The point. I think you've given us some good insight, because there isn't a lot of reporting on what the Trump team is actually doing. So you've given us some insight. But in February, Donald Trump said, I'm looking at two state, one state. I like the one that both parties like. Uh-huh. Now, Donald Trump says a lot of bizarre things. When I heard that, I didn't think, oh, that's now U.S. policy. But Ned, tell us why that was such an important thing for him to say.
Well, it's because it defines what people ought to believe, that that is our policy. It's the President of the United States, for Christ's sakes. So if he says something, people tend to believe it, and particularly in other parts of the world. And if you start talking about, well, it doesn't matter whether it's one state, two states, or something, then all of this period that we've been talking about, that we have worked very hard on for years, and we have made progress, whether we like it or not, goes down the drain.
Yeah, yeah.
And suddenly the Palestinians have absolutely no hope for the future, because their only hope is if the United States is a free and fair arbitrator of this process. And believe me, some of my conversation with Palestinians over the years, they don't always believe that.
But Natan, so has the United States abandoned its support for a two-state solution, do you believe?
In practice, I think this is one of the areas where this administration is actually the most conventional. If you think of all the other areas, we've heard a lot in these past three days. Here we've seen negotiations already, long conversations, a final deal. What would it look like? What do the both parties want? And they say it's a two-state solution. That's what we're talking about. More importantly, I think it is, though, dangerous, and the reason it's dangerous is because there's this now growing skepticism about the possibility of a two-state solution.
Yes.
And so people come up with alternatives. So for example, they talk about a one-state solution. And that is a phrase that is it's a contradiction in terms. There is no one-state solution. There is now some kind of reality in between one state and two states. You could imagine a one state in the future. Yugoslavia was one. Lebanon before the Civil War was another. But that's not a solution to the problem. That's an institutionalization of the problem. So in that sense, I think it's very dangerous. The good news is I don't think the administration has changed it fundamentally, and I don't think the sides have either. The real danger, moreover, to my mind, is not so much whether we dream about one state or a two state. That's not the real alternative. The real alternative, unfortunately, is a continuation of the status quo, which is not really static, of the current trend on which we're on. That's the real alternative. That's what most people, most Israelis and Palestinians, believe is going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And where increasing numbers think, well, we'll have to figure out how to live with that. It's an idea of managing the conflict. There is some wisdom to it, in the sense that you have to be smart about how you manage a conflict that's not going to be solved anytime soon. And I pray that I am wrong, but I don't think it's going to be solved very soon. But the danger is that you cannot manage reality often. Reality will often manage you. And I think this week in Jerusalem just shows it. We have something as delicate as the status quo in Jerusalem for what I think is fundamentally absurd reasons and yet has to be held on to.
But
so in short, I don't think the policy has changed, but I think it is a very dangerous signal as if there are genuine, viable alternatives.
Aaron, we don't have an Israeli hardliner on the panel, but there are plenty of people who believe that the two-state solution is dead. I found a column by Zev Shafetz, who wrote on the occasion of the 50th anniversary of the Six-Day War, that the two options are a state minus or status quo. And, you know, whether you can argue about the morality of this, but just strategically, he's saying the Six-Day War is over, the Israelis won, the Palestinians have to deal with it. What's wrong with that?
Well, I was told this in the mid-'80s by Maron Benvenisti, that it was 5 minutes to midnight and the game was up. You know, since leaving government in 03, my analysis has been, and Elise Labed knows this, my words here are annoyingly negative. Annoyingly negative, not because of any ideology or politics. I work for Republicans and Democrats, and I voted for both of them as well. To me, the line, dividing line for an effective American foreign policy isn't between liberal, conservative, left or right, or Republican and Democrat. It's between dumb on one hand and smart on the other. And the only thing that matters is which side of the line do you want America to be on, the smart side or the dumb side? If you want America to be on the smart side, then you start with a cruel and unforgiving look at reality. You want a two-state solution? You give me three things. I'll give you a two-state solution, or at least the chance of getting one. Number one, leaders who are masters of their political houses, not prisoners of their constituencies and their ideologies. You do not have that today. You have leaders presiding over fundamentally divided polities. The Palestinian National Movement literally looks like Noah's Ark. There are two of everything. Two constitutions, two sets of security services, two statelets, two visions of where Palestine is supposed to be and what it should be. You give me ownership that Israelis and Palestinians care more about this issue than we do. I don't know who said that in the history of the world nobody ever washed a rental car, but it's profound philosophy. You don't wash rental cars because you care only about what you own, and there is insufficient ownership.
This is Aspen Public Radio, right, broadcasting now, on KAJX Aspen and KCJX Carbondale, a live security forum broadcast during our summer membership drive. We bring you these broadcasts with your financial support. Please call 920-9000 or pledge online at aspenpublicradio.org.
You do not have that either. I met Mr. Kushner for the first time, last point, a couple months ago, and I said to him, I said, forgive me for saying this, but I wish my father-in-law had as much confidence in me as your father-in-law appears to have in you. because he's given you Mission Impossible. And we agreed it was hard, and we basically left it at that. This is not an easy deal. It involves solving the six core issues: border security, Jerusalem refugees, end of all claims, and recognition of Israel as the nation state of the Jews, the opposite of what the Palestinians want with respect to the refugee issue. You want a conflict-ending agreement? Then you need Israelis and Palestinians, two leaders, to stand before their respective polities and say the following: we may not have peace, it'll take a while, but on these six core issues, it's over. No more irredenta, no more claims to be adjudicated. It's over. And I'm sorry. What strikes me more than anything else is not the abandonment of hope, but the abandonment of illusions. And we need to start looking at the world the way it is before we get around to trying to making it the way we want it to be.
Hassan, I want to get you to respond to something that Aaron said and also ask you about the situation with the Palestinians. NPR reported this week that your government has cut back on money, provisions, and electricity to Gaza in order to pressure Hamas to relinquish power, and that has really made life tough for the people in Gaza. Why are you doing that? What's the end game there?
Yes, before that, I'm very tempted about what Aaron just said. It's very crucial because it's at the heart of this whole issue. Can the two sides sort it on their own, or they need a third party? And you know what? Israel-Palestine has been made the exception for all these years. We are the only exception to the rule, because every other conflict historically has only been solved via the intervention of a third party, because by definition, conflicts are asymmetric. So if they are capable to resolve it, there would not have been a conflict in the first place. And I can name you so many, from North Island to East Timor to South Africa to everywhere. To the U.S. role in resolving the Egyptian-Israeli and the Camp David 1 agreement. And we are always made the exception in every sphere. So if we, the Palestinians, go to the U.N., we are not supposed to use the U.N. for that reason. It becomes diplomatic terrorism. By the way, this is an Israeli term for our U.N. work. If we attempt to use international legal system, we are the exception. Only the two sides can resolve it, i.e., leave the wolf with the lamb and they will solve it. There are no lambs left in the lamb, nothing left. And there are the following three possibilities ahead of us. Let us be clear, Aaron. The first is a real fair mediator. That is Mr. Trump. The first is a third party that come and say, here it is, that gives pain, equal pain to the two sides and equal pleasure to the two sides. The second option is our non-violence resistance, because the real problem there is that there is no cost associated to all the situation. The Israeli society in Tel Aviv has no sense of crisis. And we, the one you complain about, Aaron, are the last remaining secular liberal movement in the entire region. And we propagate nonviolence, and I think we have been so successful recently in that. It has been a long journey. The last, if we fail to get Washington to intervene, we have to allow New York to intervene. Trilateralism, U.S., Israel, Palestine, does not work, then perhaps it's about time that we give a chance to the multilateral track. You know, multilateralism did work everywhere else. Let's give New York a chance, the UN a chance. And we just had a UN Security Council resolution. And there is a last, but most important to my heart, aspect of this: the bilateral relationship between Palestine and the US. That has to be taken out of the context of this trilateral relationship, US, Palestine, Israel, and the peacemaking. We stand on our own, and you have to make up your mind, America. Are we your partners? Are we the partners you want to deal with? And all what we hear about in the Congress, you know, there are all these acts against the Palestinian Authority now. Who are we exactly? I'll give you one line and then I'll end here. In the last 2 days, I've met the leaders of the U.S., you know, political and security establishments and the Congress. And many of them told me, you know, Director Pompeo joked with me and he said, I should pay taxes in Ramallah because he visits Ramallah so much. Such is the partnership between us. Such is the work that has been done. And sometimes the decision has to be made. If we are the partners, the real partners, on the ground and in many spheres, then the U.S. has to make up also its mind. Because I think we have made up our mind in 1988. Final. Our mind is the full recognition of the State of Israel on 1967 borders. Our mind is a negotiated two-state settlement. Our mind is, until we get there, nonviolent means. But apparently the U.S. is not and have not yet decided on how to deal with this issue. And so far, it has been always gauging the Israeli public opinion and the Israeli official side and trying to craft its way in that direction. We hope the new administration will provide a different dynamic. Gaza, I was born in Gaza, I lived in Gaza most of my life. What is happening is horrific, unacceptable by any standard. Gaza has been under such situation not only in the last 2 months or 1 month, as you refer to, but for the last two, three decades, particularly the last 10 years. Ever since Hamas took over, Gaza has been under blockade with all the humanitarian catastrophe that has followed. The situation there and what President Abbas has decided to do over the last few weeks has to do with Hamas, not the Gaza and the people of Gaza. President Abbas has decided to declare war against the division. That's the bottom line. President Abbas does not want to fund the division, does not want to keep the status quo. And I think it's about time, and if you follow his speech yesterday, last night, when he announced the suspension of contacts, he also called Hamas to end this division and to call for national elections, an overall elections that will allow the Palestinian people to decide. If we pride ourselves with anything, the Palestinian national movement that we still hold, the PLO still seen by the most Palestinians to be, by all Palestinians actually, to be the sole legitimate representative. If we pride ourselves with anything, it's our democratic values, and we are one of the few in the region. And I think Hamas must heed, and the only tool of pressure President Abbas has, and we have on the situation in Gaza and Hamas, is the pressure by financial means.
Natan Hassam said that people in Tel Aviv don't feel the cost of the occupation. Can you speak for Israel and tell us how most Israelis feel about the occupation, the settlements, the prospect for a deal? Give us the lay of the land, please.
Yeah, I think there's a mistake often made, which is we're conflating two different things. They're closely related, but they're not quite the same. One is Israeli control of the West Bank, the occupation, and the other is the conflict that preceded it by several decades and caused it. Most Israelis are far better off than Palestinians in Gaza, light years ahead, but they're not happy with the situation. The modal Israeli, including the right winger, the centrist right winger, is not happy about controlling civilians in the West Bank. This may surprise many. The thing is, most Israelis, by far most Israelis, have been convinced by especially the last two decades, that it doesn't matter what they do, they will not reach a peace deal. There have been six Israeli prime ministers since the Oslo agreements of 1993. Not just Netanyahu, not just Ariel Sharon. It's also Ehud Barak that Aaron Miller mentioned. It was also Ehud Olmert who went even farther. And yet there was no deal. So far from me to say that Israel is blameless or that the current policy of the Israeli government is blameless, but there are two sides to this conflict. It's not just a perpetrator of some kind of injustice and a victim of it. And when Israelis look at that, when they think about Gaza, for example, if you say Gaza in Israel, it's just shorthand. You don't even have to explain the argument. It's blatantly obvious to Israelis. Two things, especially in the last two decades. One was the Second Intifada, and the second was the disengagement from Gaza and what followed it. From the Israeli modal, the middle Israeli, how they perceive it, they went in good faith. Ehud Barak committed political suicide in Camp David. He barely had a coalition, and he knew he was going to lose the election if there was no deal, and he did by a landslide. And what followed was the Second Intifada, the most traumatic event in Israeli streets since 1949. So in Tel Aviv, people don't feel anything. Well, Israelis remember the Second Intifada, and trust me, it was way, way worse than what terrorism looks like in London during the worst days of the IRA or anything else. Several bombings a week, horrific reality, one which Israelis would not accept. So do Israelis care about the occupation? Yes, they do. I'll tell you about something else they care about, is their lives or their family, and it's their fear. The fear that it's become existential, personal. in the Gaza Strip, with the disengagement from the Gaza Strip, Israelis thought, and there's much criticism to be had about the disengagement, but in Israeli perception, the world demanded, okay, you can't reach a final status agreement, you can't solve the conflict in the summer of 2000, then end the occupation unilaterally. Then pull out. Then just stop controlling Palestinians. 2005, Ariel Sharon goes for this, and what followed was a victory by Hamas, an organization explicitly saying they will continue to fight Israel, and thousands of rockets from the Gaza Strip, and therefore a blockade. And a reality that for Palestinians in the Gaza Strip is way, way worse than before. So the modal Israeli, the short answer is, they are what I call anti-solutionists. It's not that they don't want a solution, it's not that they wouldn't prefer a two-state solution, they really would. There's still majorities in every poll in Israel for a two-state solution. But they strongly, deeply, for a long time now, don't believe it's going to happen. Palestinians, by the way, also, for the reverse reasons. And since they don't believe it's going to happen, they say, well, you can yell at me for having arthrosis in my feet, but there's nothing I can do about it. So stop yelling at me. So let me try to learn how to deal with a chronic problem. And they think that solutionists, like Americans, who think that everything can be solved with some enterprise and goodwill and just, gosh darn it, trying hard enough, we can just solve the problem, that they think, many Israelis, that's the naivete, that this is not the Midwest, it's the Middle East. Here, problems are what people enjoy for centuries. It's not what you just solve by bringing people for a week in Maryland and or Virginia and solve everything. So that's, I think, where modal Israelis are. They're not happy with the situation in Tel Aviv. They're not cost-free. When there's a conflict in Gaza, they run to the shelters with their children. That was just a couple years ago. It's much better than the situation in Gaza, light years better, but it's not one that Israelis are happy about. But that's not enough for Israelis to change. You have to tell them the theory of the case of how if they actually try to change unilaterally like in Gaza, in negotiations like all these six prime ministers, there will actually be something better, not worse. That's the difficult task, and that, I think, is why we're in such a rut now with this conflict management situation, why Netanyahu's message of I'm going to not go on big adventures, just going to keep the situation, why he wins election one after the other.
I think we're getting an idea of why this is so hard. Ned and Aaron, could you talk about the lessons learned from past failed negotiations? And if the Camp David II agreement was on the table today, would the parties sign it?
No, in large part because Arafat is the weakest participant in the summit, knowing that Barak needed an agreement, having just failed to conclude one with Hafez Assad in Geneva, realized that there was asymmetric urgency. He had no reason to make a deal. He pocketed most of Barak's risk readiness and figured that Barak would come for more. And the reality is, even under the violence that was triggered on Haram al-Sharif, Har HaBayit, and the Second Intifada, in December of 2000, we put on the table, we read to Palestinians and Israelis the Clinton parameters. I've never seen grown men write so quickly. A much improved offer from what Barak had offered at Camp David. Arafat could not accept it. We have no way to prove this, but I suspect he had been in touch, at least in his own mind, with the fact that you had a new president, a Bush, and when the name Bush came up, it was somehow associated, rightly in part, but wrongly in the main. Bush 41 and Jim Baker were extraordinarily positive forces for Israel. He figured he'd get a bigger, better deal, and he wouldn't make a decision. So Abbas could not accept what was on the table at Camp David, and Benjamin Netanyahu, who does not fashion himself. Let's be very clear about something. Don't give people tests they cannot possibly pass. I think Netanyahu makes very bad decisions strategically for the state of Israel. But his view of himself is not to be the agent of delivery to return the state of Israel to something akin to June 67 borders or to create a new reality in Jerusalem. That's not the way he views himself. And next year he will become the longest governing prime minister in the history of the state of Israel, surpassing Israel's greatest prime minister, David Ben-Gurion. He's not a speed bump. The guy has demonstrated a certain constancy and has defeated, in one way or another, every constellation of challengers. So no, the bottom line, I think, is very clear. And the lesson from Camp David 17 years ago this week is also very clear. Don't bring people to a summit when in fact there's no chance of closing. And don't bring an American president to a summit unless that president is prepared to do what is required to narrow those gaps, maybe not succeed in one round, but then come back again. And I think, and I hope, despite your faith in Mr. Trump, that he understands, and so does Mr. Kushner, the risks of failing. One last point. When we went to Camp David, Bill Clinton briefed the president twice. And at the second briefing, he said to all of us on the way out, you know, trying and failing is much better than not having tried at all. And I remember how moved and inspired I was by that. It's quintessentially American. What's wrong with trying and failing? If you don't try, if you don't get in the game, how can you possibly succeed? I'll tell you what's wrong. Failing carries a cost. Trying and failing is an appropriate slogan for the University of Michigan football team. It is not a substitute for the most consequential power on earth, because failure costs. The most powerful ideology in the world is not capitalism, it's not nationalism, it's not even democracy. It's success, because success generates power in constituents. And we have been failing far too many times because we look at the world not the way it really is, but the way we want it to be, which is ennobling and wonderful. That's how things change, but you have to at least start with the baseline of what's real.
Ned, what lessons do you draw from your many years negotiating this?
The lessons in this particular case is we went to Camp David in a hurry. We weren't properly prepared for it. We had promised Arafat that he wouldn't be blamed if it failed. Well, my God, you don't do that with a party to the process. It immediately gives him a get-out-of-jail-free card. And then we turned around and blamed him. So we made a lot of mistakes. It was a lot of pressure because Barack was trying to be reelected. There was pressure on him, and the president was ending his tenure. So he wanted to get a deal. But you can't rush these things. And, you know, we've talked about some of the problems here. And you might come away from this saying, it's impossible. Oh, my God. That's not true. Look, even with the question of the Al-Aqsa Mosque problem, does that mean, and Abbas is saying he's not going to cooperate with the Israelis anymore, that does not mean that they're not cooperating on security. The security cooperation still goes on. I take that as a very positive signal that this is not the end of the line. And we've got a long way to go, yes, because from my perspective, I came out of the Y negotiations put in charge of trying to help the sides do away with incitement. Well, incitement is a problem, and it does make it harder to come to agreement. There's a lot of things that can be done, though, both to prepare for the next round, whatever it might be, but also to plan for the next round.
We're getting close to the end of our time, so I'd like to throw it out to the audience for some questions. There are microphones, and if you could, are there microphones? Stand up and state your name. Do we have a mic?
Yep.
There we go. This gentleman over here? There we go. Great.
Yeah. My name is Herb Levitt. I just had a question. I looked at a map recently of the settlements in the West Bank. And after looking at that, okay, the idea of a two-state solution seems to be absolutely impossible. I mean, I'd like to hear someone comment that that is possible.
If you allow me,
Hassan, go ahead.
Because this is exactly the relevant question. The relevant question is there really a sufficient collective decision in the side of Israel to go for the two-state solution? Plus, minus, as we know it. We all know the solution. And this question is the exact question. Only the last week, Israel has announced the building of another 8,200 units.
How many settlers are there total?
Total 650,000 now. And we started the Oslo peace process in 1993.
That includes East Jerusalem.
That is included.
Yeah, that includes. Yes, of course, it includes East Jerusalem. Yeah. We do include East Jerusalem in the occupied territories. So does the U.S. and the rest of the world.
Right.
We started the peace process with 125,000 settlers, and then 20 years later, during the peacemaking that Aaron was talking about, we ended up with 650,000, and the number is soaring to reach 1 million very soon. That's the pledge of Mr. Netanyahu. And this is the equation, sir. I'm going to give you an American sort of example. If you and I decide to share a piece of pizza, and then I start eating it while we're talking, then I'm not serious. I'm not serious. And you know what? How funny it is. It's dark and it is dramatic. And it is really heartbreaking that people on the ground see this reality that you've just asked about. I have two points to raise. First is about what the whole discussion about the Israeli society caring. Of course, the Israeli society, like all the other societies, they are not exceptional. They want peace. I'm sure if you ask them, 70% say they are for the two-state solution. But if you ask them a second question, do you want it now? They are not as in a sense of urgency as we are. Why? Because, okay, sporadically there are issues. But the truth is, my friend, the truth is, the per capita income in Israel is $40,000. In the West Bank, it's $2,800. In Gaza, it's $1,400. And there is only half an hour from a city to a city. You know the water consumption per year globally, the poverty rate, is 50 liters per person per day. In the West Bank, it's 60.
But let's try to answer his question.
I'm sorry.
How do we deal with that?
This is the heart of it. Forget about politics and ideology. This is the heart of it. When the Israeli average person consume our water, our own water in the West Bank, 300 per person per day. The settlers, 365. This is the UN statistics. And then they sell us water, you just mentioned the water agreement, at higher prices than the international market. This is the occupation and this is the reality. The reality is not just about what form of an agreement we're going to get to. The reality is this confrontation that we just mentioned last 2 days is about the rules of engagement and respecting people's lives. Firing live bullets on the bodies of teenagers without any calculation, is what spiraled.
Okay, but we need to answer this gentleman's question, which is, how does the deal work?
Yes or no?
The answer is, how does the deal work with all these?
It's not too late. It's not too late. I'll tell you one thing.
So how does it work?
I'll tell you how it works. It's very simple. And by the way, you know what? The Palestinian-Israeli issue, in my opinion, is way less complicated than the Syrian situation or the Iraqi situation or any other situation. Because we don't have the ethnic issues and the 14 groups against each other. It's a very straightforward line. There is a global consensus that the two-state solution, the 1967 borders, is the line. We have accepted it collectively in the Palestine National Council. Yes, Arafat. We have recognized Israel. We have gone into a journey of abandoning the one-state solution that we started our revolution with. Right, Aaron? One democratic state. But we knew all these years that that was a non-starter for Israel. And we think that reaching that solution requires a fair third party. Now, so long as you leave this asymmetric situation, and so long you leave it to the balance of power, the equation is this. The Israeli center-left will always start with, or the starting point is, what is ours, and what is yours is negotiable. And we have lived that all along. And by the way, I'm sorry, Aaron, the narrative you have just outlined about the Camp David is not what we know and is not what we have experienced. And blaming Yasser Arafat for it is unfair. But this is for another discussion. I'm not going to go into it at this point in time. I'm not going to go in. And you know what? This is exactly what I meant by the U.S. mediation and being separated from the Israeli narrative. The second and the most crucial point here is that the center-right and the center-right are way more honest, Ken, and way more straightforward than the center-left in Israel. What is mine, and what is yours is also mine. And you know what? This is the equation. How do you deal with it? Either we negotiate, and we have negotiated for 25 years, and the third party could not deliver, or we go into non-violent means, the United Nations.
But I think what he's getting at is United how many Nations settlers have to be displaced?
Bloodlessly raising the cost of occupation. In the Congress now, there is a bill, there is an act against the boycott campaigns. So what are we supposed to do exactly? Passionately, I'm saying.
How many settlements have to be removed?
What are we? No.
How does the map work, Natan?
It's not good. The map you've seen and the reality you see if you drive is not auspicious for a two-state solution. I don't think it's dead. In particular, because if you look at most of the negotiation plans that have been done, including some of the Palestinian leadership has been involved with. They have always insisted very consistently that it's 67 line, but there has also been discussion sometimes, in their perspective, very limited, swaps of land one-to-one in quality and size.
It has been accepted by the Palestinians?
It has been accepted by the Palestinians, exactly. The Israelis have other formulations, but they've often talked about swaps. Much of the growth you see in the number of settlers are either in East Jerusalem in neighborhoods that, under most of the peace plans, would be part of Israel, next to Israel, or main Israel, whatever you want to call it, or in two very large settlements that are actually ultra-Orthodox, which is not very nationalist. It's not national religious, but ultra-Orthodox. They're right adjacent to the Green Line, and in many sense, they're the easiest from a peace plan perspective. There are some very difficult points. There's one large settlement in the northern West Bank, what Israelis call Samaria. There are neighborhoods in East Jerusalem. Some of them would be very problematic in terms of contiguity between Bethlehem, East Jerusalem, and Ramallah. There are many very serious issues. This is a serious problem, but I don't think it's insurmountable. In terms of numbers, of the 600,000 you hear, there are several serious peace plans, including by Israeli security, former security officials, that talk about maybe 100,000, maybe a bit more, that have to be evacuated. That is a very large, difficult number for a democracy to do, but it is not 600,000. And moreover, I've been so pessimistic about the chances. A lot of what can be done now can address this as well, can address the inequities that Hossam mentioned, can address a lot of the problems that we see today with the status quo right now, and can lead in the direction of a two-state solution long before we can agree exactly what the border would be or whether we can reach it. Right now, we're pretending that we're managing the situation. We're talking, but both parties are not doing what is needed to move us in that direction. And that can be done, and I think would also alleviate dramatically the legitimate concerns about the settlement map and growth.
Okay, we're almost out of time. Elise Labbitt. Microphone. Okay. Fire away.
Lisa Rice, Secretary Kerry, and now it seems Jared Kushner and Jason Greenblatt are trying, which is, you know, to bring it into the Arab fold. Now, I know we have the Arab Peace Initiative, but there have been various ways that the Arabs have been involved. Now it seems as if trying to use a trade-off for Israel to become part of this coalition of moderate states to, counter some of the other challenges in the region in exchange for some progress on the Palestinian equation. What can the Arabs do here to help push this along? I think that there's been, you know, an over-reliance on the U.S. as the sole mediator, but especially with the lack of experience of this administration, I'm wondering if they have a greater role to play.
Ned, you have some insight into that.
I went around the Arab League after the collapse of Camp David and talked to the leaders in each of 17 countries. The one thing that I found that was compelling for me was that, except for Jordan and Egypt, none of them really gave a damn. And I think this is where you get into a problem with the Arabs taking the lead on some kind of a solution. You have to have people that are actually engaged and have something to lose and something to gain. And they don't. I mean, I went to Tunisia, and the only thing he was worried about was the press coverage in Paris. And it was sort of that way all the way around the journey, except for, I say, the two places, Egypt and Jordan. And both of them have Palestinian issues. And they are going to have to be a part of the final results of any kind of a negotiation. So I'm not as negative or as discouraged as I would think would come out of this discussion. And I certainly anticipate that there is more opportunity here than we may even realize. And I agree with Natan. There are things that be done today, things that, like the security cooperation, things that can give confidence on both sides. The other side is actually engaged and interested in a peace. Up till now, that doesn't really exist. But we can help create that. We can. That's the role of the United States.
Aaron, end us on a
I would only say, you have just finished a book called The End of Greatness, Why Americans Can't Have and Don't Want Another Great President. In the end, every time we've had a breakthrough in the Israeli-Palestinian, Arab-Israeli conflict, it's always been because we've had individuals who are prepared to risk, and individuals who understood their political constituencies, and even if they didn't, were prepared to risk. If John Keegan, the military historian, were here, he'd say that six men between the years 1920 and 1950 were responsible for most of the death, destruction, devastation, and prospects of peace, security, and prosperity for most of the Western world. Six individuals? And Marx is right. Karl was right. Men, he wrote in the 19th century, make history, but rarely as they please. Sure, circumstances constrain individuals. But if you don't have leaders, if you don't have people like Sadat, Hussein, Rabin, and Arafat in his first incarnation, I don't see how. And an American president who's prepared to apply ample amounts of honey and vinegar. Honey and vinegar. Kissinger, Carter, and Baker. They all got into fights with the Israelis and the Arabs. And they still produced things that the Israelis found quite remarkable. But you got to have people willing to stand up. And until we do, you know, if I come back here next year, we're going to be having the same conversation.
Well, we are out of time.
Hopefully not.
Thank you all very much. Thanks for listening, guys.